another interview, was with Charles Porter, he talked about that situation in Springfield, and he talked about his conversations with George Weyerhaeuser and a lawsuit that he initiated.
Who did?
Charles Porter.
Oh.
Eugene lawyer. And you remember any awareness of that?
You know, I have sort of a hazy recollection of that now that you mention it, but I don't quite remember what that lawsuit was about.
Well, it was about he was connected with U of O professors in measuring air pollutants and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And he issued a threat or an ultimatum that if in so many years they would do it again, and it wasn't produced appreciably, that they would then go back to court.
You know, I remember that, but I can't recall the details of that.
Well, as it turned
principally
out,
because it didn't amount to much.
Well, as it turned out, they found that the pollutants had been reduced very impressively.
Yeah.
So they told George Weyerhaeuser that they could congratulate him this time.
Oh.
But the next time, he had still further to go.
Yeah. One of the things that I recall very vividly, there was a farmer who lived across the river, that is on the north side of the river, from the Weyerhaeuser plant, and who had a pasture, some pasturage out there. And this pasture, in the winter and the spring, would be partially flooded. There would be ponds that were standing, as they often do on that land down there in the spring and the wintertime. And he sued Weyerhaeuser on the basis that he had lost cattle, and these cattle had died that had pastured there. And he claimed that the Weyerhaeuser was putting something into the river that traveled through the ground and came up in his pasture and caused his cattle to be sick. And that's why his cattle died. So you had emotional things like this happening, and he was very emotional about it. And we had to hire some Oregon State scientists to study that, and they found out that in this wet pasturage, there was some sort of parasite that lived there, and that parasite got into his cattle, and that's what killed his cattle. But you could never convince him, even then, that it wasn't the Weyerhaeuser, that it wasn't Weyerhaeuser that did it. A very emotional thing. And so we had problems like that that we had to handle all the time, from the standpoint, had to inform the press what we're doing and give them the results of these studies, and this was a continuing public relations problem, and it went on for a number of years, and we kept improving the treatment of the effluent that we put in the river, and they kept improving the controls on air pollution. But it was difficult to convince these people that we were really doing something. So we publicized rather frequently the money that we had expended on pollution control. But it's sort of indicative of what happens, I think, in communities that, oh, they just desire to get a new business or a new industry. But after it's there, and it creates some traffic problems and some other congestion problems, then they begin to have second thoughts, and they're not sure they want it there. And sort of typical of these two professors who said to me when I said, well, gee, if you didn't have Weyerhaeuser here, you know, just imagine what would happen to this community of Springfield. It wouldn't be what it is today. Well, we don't care whether Weyerhaeuser's here or not. That was their attitude. And I think a lot of people react that way.
Sometimes a PR situation can be almost impossible to handle, it sounds like. Well, what does it really take to handle these? What does it take from you as a PR person to handle these situations?
Well,
special
One of the first things, of course, is to inform your own employees as to what you're doing, and that was a part of my job too, although I was the link between Dacoma's attitude and what their policy, that the company policy was, and the local branch, or the operation at Springfield. And Springfield had its own PR person, but I was the link between them. But I did handle a lot of press relations. Even at that level sometimes, particularly with those media people who were outside of the Springfield area, like the Oregonian, the Journal, Roseburg News Review, and organizations like this. And I always kept in close touch with the publishers and the editors, both at Springfield and Eugene, at the Eugene Register Guard. Had a very good relationship with the owner of the paper at Springfield, particularly, and also with the Eugene Register Guard. Which often helped a great deal when we ran into some problems locally, like, for example, when Springfield tried to annex the Weyerhaeuser operation at the city of Springfield. We had built that plant probably, 2 miles maybe outside of the Springfield city limits. But after we were there, homes began creeping out, and pretty soon they were within a half mile of the plant. Well, Harms, what was his first name? Was the mayor of Springfield. Harms, H-E-R-M-S. And they were looking for additional industrial property to annex because they needed money. And so the city decided to annex Weyerhaeuser. Pardon?
This is the cherry stem operation.
Yeah. Did I already discuss that?
Right.
Well.
But we hadn't gotten into, you know, that sidelight, your relations with
because I had a good relationship with the Springfield News and the Eugene Register Guard, I was able to tell our story pretty thoroughly in the papers and point out that what they were trying to do is to reach out with a cherry stem and take the cherry at the end of it. And therefore the annexation was defeated in an election. And later on we agreed that if they took in the whole area, we would not oppose it. But that there was about 3 or 4 years in which we didn't have to pay that tax that we would have had to pay if that cherry stem thing had gone through. And that was a considerable amount.
Well, with regard to dealing with the press, there were some usefully good relations with press people. Were there some nuts that you couldn't crack? Were there some people that... Did you encounter some hostilities in individual cases that made it very difficult to work with press people?
Well, I think the only problem I ever had with the press that was very difficult, I found it very difficult to work with, was with the, what was it, the Portland, was it the World? the paper that started publishing when the Oregon Journal went on a strike.
The Observer, was it?
No, it was The World, wasn't it?
I'm not sure.
I think it was The World. Remember, the owner of the Coos Bay Times. It started out, it had another name at first. The Reporter, the Portland Reporter. That paper I had problems with. The reporters that I dealt with, had to deal with, were oriented toward a feeling that you couldn't trust any big business, and that the only interest that a corporation had was in making bucks, a fast buck. And there were attacks on logging, timber cutting, pollution, and you try to explain what we were doing, and sometimes met with just hostility. That wasn't always true, because finally I seemed to get along pretty well with them. But at first it was very difficult, because they were almost like the reporters for The Reporter, and then later The World, which is The Reporter had been renamed The World. It was almost as if they felt that they couldn't trust any public relations person who worked for a large corporation. They were very cynical about it, and they seemed to regard me as someone who would mislead them, who would never tell them the truth, you know. But eventually I got to know some of them pretty well, and I didn't have much of a problem anymore. That was about the only one that I ever had a problem with. And the only other time I had any much of a problem was when they were fighting the timber tax battle, and there was an editor down at Wheeler on the coast who wrote just a real diatribe about Weyerhaeuser and how it was a monopoly and all that sort of thing. And I couldn't get anywhere with this fellow. I call him and I couldn't get a meeting with him or anything. And I finally decided, well, the Wheeler paper was so insignificant anyway that I was wasting time. I had some problems occasionally with the Medford Mail Tribune. Trying to remember the name of the editor down there. Rule was the editor. And to give you an example of the kind of problem I had, Weyerhaeuser had a forest road down in the south of Roseburg, and there was a man named Lafferty who was an old-time lawyer who ran for Congress. And he wrote an article and sent it to the Medford Mail Tribune about how terrible Weyerhaeuser was and how it had stolen its timber and all kinds of stuff like that. And I don't remember what year this was anymore, but the Medford Mail Tribune just ran the thing as if it was something that some reporter had written. And and I wrote a letter to this Rule and said, you know, there's no truth to this thing. And what this article said was that Weyerhaeuser had acquired much of its timber by hiring people to establish timber claims in the early days. And then they would, they, in other words, committed fraud to get their timber. And some things like that were in this article. And so I wrote Ruble a letter and said, you know, you could have at least put a byline on it so that people would know who wrote this thing. It sounded as if it was something that some of your reporters had written. And he just really got angry about that. Wrote me a real snotty letter about it. This guy was not a guy that they would buy a line. And besides, he thought that this guy ought to get some coverage, this Lafferty, because nobody else was giving him any. But then after that, I never had any. I had a few little problems like that with the Medford Mail Tribune, but they were insignificant, really. The Coos Bay World, I had some problems with occasionally. They had an editor at one time who I think later worked for the Reporter here in Portland. And he also was very, very cynical about business people and public relations men. And it was very difficult sometimes trying to tell him that some of the things he'd had put in the paper were not correct. But other than that, we didn't have any problems, really. I really had a very good relationship with the media. One other one that I had problems with was the Oregon. It was an attempt to start a magazine called the Oregon Times. Oregon Times. And I believe Phil Stanford might have been working for that. It sort of rings a bell. And that was a difficult one, too, to handle, because those people were that way. They just didn't trust business people at all. And yet, you would have thought they would start to realize that a public relations person, if he's going to be successful, has to be truthful, because if he starts being untruthful, he's soon discovered as being untruthful, and therefore he's lost all influence. Same way with a lobbyist. But they never seem to see it that way. I tried to tell them that, but and I must admit there are some bad apples among public relations people. But to look at them generally as being that way is not correct.
There would be a difference between just straight public relations and going to the public to help to create an image or address a problem in dealing with legislators. It seems to me that the credibility would have to be more directly maintained with the latter.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But the same thing really applies. If you're going to handle the day-to-day media contacts with a corporation, you have just got to win the trust of people in the press and the media. You know, otherwise, if you get into a bad situation where you're being criticized for something that maybe you shouldn't be criticized for, you just don't have any influence because those people won't believe you. So you have to build up this aura of trust, and it's got to be genuine. And if you ever fail at that, then it takes you a long time to recover, or you may never recover. They'll always look at you askance.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that I tried to develop. If there was a media person who was critical and unjustly so, I tried to show them by taking them out to a plant or out in the woods and show them what the true facts were. And I raised a lot of tours for that purpose, not only our own land, but I did it for the industry as a whole sometimes. we had an organization called American Forest Products Institute, and I was on their local committee, their regional committee, and then I used to work with the Industrial Forestry Association, the West Coast Lumbermen's Association, and Western Forest Products Association. And all of those organizations had a public relations function to give media people and the public generally a true picture of what was going on in forestry. And then associated Oregon industries used to have some tours for the same purpose. And some of those I organized, and many of them I participated in. And there was not a much better way to handle media people than to actually show them what's going on. Then, during the period in 57 and 58, when I was the corporate publicity director. See, I was moved out of Oregon, out of Portland, in 1957 to Tacoma. And my job was to be corporate publicity director. And I was in that position until late 50, was during 57, 58. And then because of the problem we were having with timber taxation and all the experience I had in the Oregon legislature, they asked me if I wanted to stay in Tacoma or go back down here. They upgraded the job in Oregon, and so I came back. But during the time I was publicity director, I took many people from the Eastern media on tours, and one of them was Smith.
Howard
K. Smith, an interesting person. He was interested in the political situation in the Northwest, and also in what was happening in forestry. And so I took him all around Washington and Oregon, and where he saw various politicians and press people and I've forgotten who we all visited, but that was one of the things I did during that period. And I did that at the same time when I was down here serving as the public affairs manager in Oregon. I did a lot of that kind of thing, not only with media people, but with agency people. They might be a federal agency people, they might be state agency people, fish and game people, or forestry department people, not so much the forestry department, because they knew pretty much what was going on. But some of the agency people, people from the Environmental Quality Commission, and I'd take them around and show them what we were doing to prevent pollution, what we're doing in forestry and that sort of thing. So, and that was a very rewarding experience, incidentally.
It really required a lot of activity.
Yes. Well, maybe I should go on with some of the other issues that...
Yeah, one of the big ones that we've identified for quite a while is the issue of labor and the various labor-related issues that came up.
Well, I might begin this by saying that I had a very good relationship with a labor lobby. It was George Brown and Rosie McDonald. And I had a particularly good relationship with those two people. George Brown had been the man who organized the Weyerhaeuser plant at Klamath Falls, and then went to the FFL-CIO as a lobbyist eventually. Rosie McDonald, I think he had been a meat cutter, came out of that union, and a sort of short, roly-poly person, just a lot of fun, good sense of humor, and was called Rosie because every morning, and he came to work, without fail, he had a fresh rose in his lapel. Every morning, a little fresh rosebud.
Not a rosy complexion, but a natural.
Yes, just an awfully nice guy. But I cross swords with those people a lot because, but we always maintain a very friendly relationship despite it. Because many of the bills that labor was pushing were harmful to Weyerhaeuser and to other industry in their particular context. Jim Maher was another labor lobbyist, and he was a different kind of guy. He was, it's hard to describe what he was, but he threatened legislators a lot. And I would see him sometimes in the gallery during a time that a labor bill was being heard. And he would be throwing notes down to certain legislators that he felt were kind of in labor's pocket. Yeah. No, I didn't see him do that a lot, but I saw him do it. And he was sort of in a sense, I got along with him well, but he pushed very hard. And he got angry easily. And I often thought that labor would have been better served if they had just let George Brown and Rosie McDonald handle all the lobbying. But George Brown was just a nice guy, sort of quiet, good sense of humor, never talked very loud, just sort of easygoing, and just a good representative for labor. Well, I said I crossed swords with him a lot, and that was mostly on workmen's compensation, workers' compensation and unemployment compensation matters. Almost every session, labor would have a bill in, or a number of bills in, to increase the benefits on workers' compensation there, and they were always trying labor was always trying to get more liberalization of the laws that dealt with workers' compensation. And the same way with unemployment compensation. They wanted the benefits to run for a longer period of time. They wanted to increase the benefits. And sometimes maybe they might have been right. I don't know. But certainly, industry compromised a lot with labor, but there was a point at which you didn't want to compromise anymore because it was too costly. Weyerhaeuser, at that time, in those early days, like 53, 54, 55, 56, along in there, was a self-insurer, as it still is. But the law at that time was what we call the two-way law. You could either insure yourself, in which case you were open to suit anytime you had an injury.